Cincinnati baseball fan 50 years old or more, the glory years were the mid-1970s, the era of the Big Red Machine. The Reds assembled a team not only filled with some of the greatest players of the 20th century, but also some of the biggest personalities to ever play together on a single sports team: Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, Joe Morgan, George Foster. Who held it all together? Who was the glue that made it work? There's no one answer, but Tony Perez would certainly be part of every answer. John Arardi has just published a new book entitled Tony Perez, From Cuba to Cooperstown. John is back with Howard Wilkinson, and we turn now to the legacy of Tony Perez. Because we have pre-recorded this show, we cannot take calls today. Okay, so new book, why Tony Perez? I mean, there's been lots of different books written about the Big Red Machine, but why did you take this one on at this time?
Well, a lot of books about the Big Red Machine, but not about Tony Perez. That's number one. Number two, he's the only Cuban major leaguer to make our National Baseball Hall of Fame. And number three is I just wanted to go to Cuba, simply put. I basically parted ways with the Enquirer during the downsizing, December 2014. It took about a year to plan the trip to Cuba. Wasn't easy. Communist country. And 2.5 years later, here we are with a completed book.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I mean, there's been so many books about the Big Red Machine. And obviously, Tony plays a big part in all of them.
Right.
But there's never been one that looks at him, and he has a unique story among those guys.
He definitely does. And what's interesting about that, and you know, Howard, from having read the book, is that Tony, despite cooperating with me wonderfully for 30 years when I was covering the Reds, he decided he didn't want a book because he's too humble, basically, too modest. So I figured, well, maybe and I got all the other guys in there talking about him, but I called Joe Morgan. Well, first, Joe was in town for the Pete Rose statue dedication, and I said, Joe, can I use you as a blurb for the back of the book? He said, sure. He said, but I'll have to call Tony first. Well, needless to say, Tony didn't want Joe's endorsement on the book because Tony didn't want a book. But what was interesting about what Joe told me, he said, I said to Tony, he said, Tony, you deserve a biography because you're a Hall of Famer. This is the guy to do it, John Arardi. He covered you all those years. And most importantly, I want to know who you are. I want to know who you were before I met you in 1972. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, there's a great enough reason to do the book. It would have been great to have that as a blurb, but I felt like everything was validated because I felt a little bit on thin ice with Tony. We had a great relationship with his wife, Patuca, and his kids, Eduardo and Victor, but I felt uneasy about having done the book. But after hearing that from Joe, I said, well, that validates everything.
Yeah, and one of the things about Tony, I mean, and I know he's modest. I know he doesn't like the, me.
Right.
But there were some hard memories in there for him, too.
There were, and that has a lot to do with
this book.
And the interesting thing about it is at one point, Eduardo, his second son, was working for ESPN and wanted to go to Cuba to do a story on his dad. This is just before I think it was the 2015 game, December 2015, that Obama spurred on. Well, what happened was Tony said, Eduardo, I respect the fact you're working for ESPN, but I can't go back. There's basically too many scars, too many wounds, and I can't go with you to Cuba and do that story. Well, I'm thinking to myself, if he doesn't go with his own son, what are my chances? So I wasn't surprised when he said he didn't want to do the book. But you're right, there were a lot of scars, and Tony basically couldn't be with his family for 10 years between 63, right after the Missile Crisis, and 72 when he went back home. So yeah, I mean, his father, mother, two brothers, and three sisters never got to see him play an inning of professional baseball, let alone the major leagues.
One of the things that's always fascinated me about Tony was, he was Reds picked him up in 1960, brought him to the United States, brought him to Florida at first, to the spring training complex. He had grown up in this communist country. A repressive society, but it was a society that did not have racial discrimination.
Correct.
And suddenly he was finding out they were telling him, well, you can't stay in this hotel. Mm-hmm. You have to drink out of that water fountain, not this water fountain. And he was, well, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
Where am I?
Yeah, that's right. And he couldn't go into the restaurants when he was on the road with his teammates and their white Chevy station wagons with the three red seats. One of them faced the back one facing backward, facing the drivers behind them. He had to stay in the car and eat his sandwich. He couldn't go in, and he barely spoke the language. I mean, we're mainly talking now about Rocky Mount, North Carolina, which was year three. Year four would have been Macon, Georgia, year before the Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act of 1964. There's a picture in the book of the crowd, and you can't see it in the picture, but there's a rope going up the middle of the crowd because whites on one side, blacks on the other. Drinking fountains, whites only, blacks only, bathrooms the same way. The only place Tony had sanctuary was obviously the ball field and the clubhouse, but that's where he wanted to feel most comfortable. And eventually, he really didn't truly arrive as a superstar until 64. He was the most valuable player of the Pacific Coast League. That's when he knew he was going places. But, you know, again, and you know this to this day, is his English isn't that good. So when he was coming up, he even told me he had to eat chicken one day, one week, every night for dinner because he knew no other word.
Yeah.
And this is a guy, again, language problems, acclimatization problems. Obviously, racism was huge in three of his 5 years in the minors. So he went through an awful lot. And that's the quote from Johnny Bench. How can we know what this guy achieved without walking in his shoes? And that's right. Absolutely true.
That quote from Johnny that you used in the book just struck me.
Yeah.
I said, well, that perfectly describes it. And I remember Johnny saying that at the dedication to the statue.
So what did the organization, what did the Reds organization try to do to help facilitate that transition?
Well, actually, not much, Dan, because what happened was, and I talked to some players of today, and today we have translators. You don't have to speak Spanish. Every ball club is required to have a translator. Well, Tony didn't have that deal. The one thing the club did right was after that first season in Geneva, despite a pretty good year, not a great year, but a pretty good year, Pete Rose went up to the next level, Art Shamsky the same way, Tony stayed behind. And I'd always heard it was the philosophy of Phil Segi, the Reds farm director, that if you have a Latino who's having a little bit of a difficult time adjusting, give him that extra year. And that extra year was so valuable to Tony because year two in Geneva, New York, he just killed it. I mean, I think he hit 348, maybe 100 RBI, something like 37 home runs, whatever it was, in 100 games. It was crazy. And again, I said he didn't arrive as a superstar until 64 in San Diego, but he knew after year two in Geneva, hey, maybe I've got a future in this game. He didn't know it after year one. He wasn't sure if he was going home to Cuba that offseason or the next offseason. But when he had that big year in 60, I guess it was one 61. In Geneva,
yeah.
Then he said, okay, I might be able to play this game.
It's funny you mentioned Rose and Shamsky. And obviously they were his teammates
right.
in Geneva that first year.
Right.
I had a conversation with Art Shamsky at the Major League Fan Fest at the All-Star Game a few years ago. And
right.
he was talking about Geneva. He said, we loved Tony. Pete and I loved to hang out with Tony.
Right.
And mainly because he taught us all the Spanish cuss words.
That's funny.
He was, we became friends with him.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that year one, you mentioned Shamsky and Rose, is that Rose comes in 3 weeks late because they graduated late from West High. I think it was the middle of June. Well, the rookie league ball was already underway for two or three weeks. And Pete gets there to the manager's clubhouse, and the manager says, who are you? And Pete doesn't say, I'm Pete Rose from Cincinnati. He says, I'm your new second baseman. And the old second baseman was Tony Perez. And that very night, Tony made an error in game in the eighth inning. And the manager was so upset, he put Tony on a disabled list, decided, I'm going to make a profit out of this Pete Rose kid, puts him at second base. And when Tony came back off the DL, which, by the way, he was never on again the rest of his career, when Tony comes back, he's a third baseman, which is how he gets to the big leagues, basically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But how often does that happen? Because, Howard, you know your baseball. One, I call Pete Rose a Hall of Famer. One Hall of Famer replacing another one
right.
in rookie ball at the same position.
Just
I don't think it ever happened before.
No.
So who did Perez bond with? What players did he bond with early on? You mentioned Shamsky and Rose.
Right.
Did they really bond and then stick together?
Definitely. And Tommy Helms the same way. Lee May was a great teammate, gave him his nickname, the Big Dog. But the guy that Tony admired was, above all others, was Frank Robinson. And Tony said if Frank had hung around longer, if they hadn't traded him, which, by the way, that should be a national day of mourning in Cincinnati, but it probably is. Yeah. After they traded Frank, Tony was – I wouldn't say he was on his own because he had a great roommate in Chico Ruiz. And then in 70 when Concepcion came, Concepcion was his roommate on the road. But Frank was a big loss to Tony because he told me, he said, I copied everything Frank did right on down the way. I put my socks on and my shoes. And there's a picture in a book where they're being introduced to the fans at the 1965 Meet the Reds luncheon. And Tony's hands are crossed the same as Frank Robinson's, who was standing next to him. So he definitely copied Frank in every way possible.
So what we when we get up into the 70s
right.
and talk about sort of the how that team came together, the big red machine came together, how do you see his role on that team?
Well, the best example I can give is that great mural of mosaics they have at the ballpark where Tony's front and center. That is how he was known among his teammates. And in fact, Bob Crotty, who runs the Green Diamond Gallery, he explained to me he did a private dinner for the Grade 8 one time, and they all had the name tags set up at the table. Obviously, nobody paid attention to the name tags, but only Tony was the one guy that moved among the African-Americans, the Latinos, and the whites. And that was a great team of mixed ballplayers because, as Pete says, we may not have been the greatest team of all time, but we were the most entertaining team of all time. And it had a lot to do with the melting pot background of the entire team. But Tony was the guy that Sparky would go to when he had real problems in the clubhouse. Now, granted, he did the same thing with Rose and Bench and Morgan, but he told Tony one time, he said, Tony, it's your clubhouse. I expect you to fix this. And I've always told people, if you can be funny in one language, that's great. Or you can be a leader in one language, that's great. If you can be a leader in two languages, which is Tony Perez, or funny in two languages, Jose Rijo, that's off the charts. And that's what a great man Tony Perez was, basically.
Yeah, Tony, I mean, he seemed to be the one guy who can move between the different factions in that clubhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And you know there were factions.
For sure.
You know, the Rose faction, the Bench faction, mm-hmm. But he was the one who bridged the gap and that everybody liked. Nobody disliked him.
That's right. There was some, let's face it, you know these guys, you've dealt with them. There's huge egos in that clubhouse.
Yeah.
Rose mm-hmm. and Morgan and Bench, I mean, those are pretty good egos. But Tony, legitimately, one of the few players I met, even though baseball is an individual game and a team concept, the idea is that you put winning first. Well, Pete Rose, as great as he was, he always knew his stats. But Tony definitely was one of those guys who put winning first. And the other players knew it, knew he didn't have an agenda, which is why they all got along with him so well.
Well, you wrote about this in the book a little bit, about his relationship with Joe Morgan. And Joe, when he came to the Reds, I mean, he had a pretty big head.
Sure.
He had a pretty big mm-hmm. head in that clubhouse.
Mm-hmm.
But Tony was a guy who could needle him and needle him and kind of, take a little wind out of his sails.
Right.
And he helped him become part of that team and
definitely.
more of a team player than an individual.
To this day, I mean, Tony still says to him, "Nobody knew who you were unless came to play for the Big Red Machine."
Right, exactly.
And Joe came over here from Houston. He had a great four, five, six year career in Houston. But when he got here, of course, he lockered next to Pete. But Tony was the guy that kept him in his place. And what's interesting about it is that Joe came over here wanting to give Tony a tough time about being a butcher at third base. But, of course, he didn't get the chance because Tony moved to first when Lee May got traded to Houston. So Joe didn't get the chance. But actually, this isn't widely known. This is in the book, too. Tony led the league, National League, in 1971 for range, defensive range by a third baseman. So he was just getting the hang of it when he got moved. So he's a better defensive player than people give him credit for.
Yeah, I think probably like somebody like Pete Rose would tell you that. And, Pete played third base,
right?
And Tony had better range,
definitely.
Talk a little bit about Patuca.
Patuca, who is who I really wanted to write the book about.
Right. Yeah,
Tony's wife, and right. She and I have had a great relationship, and I've always said she's the embodiment of a ball player's wife, not in the negative context as though she's some kind of fawning individual, because she took great care of him and she took great care of the other players' wives. And she was his greatest backer, and she would get the most upset when he didn't get his accolades from the previous night's game in the next day's paper. There's one incident where she woke him up, and she was basically in a rage at whatever it was, 9 o'clock in the morning. She got her Morning Enquirer, and Tony got the game-winning hit. There were no quotes. They were quoting Rose and Bench. And Paterka wakes up Tony and says, look at this paper, Tony, look at this paper. And Tony looks at it. He says, no problem. Goes back to sleep. He said, wake me up at 1 o'clock. Have my fish ready. I'll be ready to go to the ballpark. And she did that. And there's all kinds of stories about her. I mean, a priest somewhere on the west side might give a homily in which he mentions Tony. The very next day, Paterka is at the sacristy with an autographed bat and ball to give the priest for what he said. Fans would write letters to the ball club defending Tony and how he was the greatest Red of all. And Paterka would find out about the letter. She'd call the person at home, have a nice conversation with them. And she, you know, she is to this day, I think, the perfect embodiment of what the conduit is between a ball player and the community, and that is so valuable.
Where did they meet?
They met, and this story I like a lot because Paterka grew up in Cardenas, Cuba, which is the closest point to Key West. That's where Elian Gonzalez left from on the raft. And she had to leave Cuba in, I think, 1961 with her dad and two sisters. Her dad was a contractor, and as happened with so many people there, if you had property, Castro was going to take it, was going to nationalize it. A lot of people think it was just the Americans that got screwed in that deal. No, it was everybody, including the sugar mill owners who were Cuban. They lost their sugar mills. Well, what happened was Paterka moved to Santiago, I think it was Santiago, Puerto Rico, with her family. Tony meets her in October of 64 when he couldn't get a visa to go to play winter ball in Venezuela with Pete Rose. He winds up going to Puerto Rico. His roommate is Jose Martinez, a middle infielder for the Pittsburgh Pirates. He says, Tony, I want you to meet a wonderful family from Cardenas, Cuba. It turns out to be the Paterka family, De La Cantera family. Tony meets her. 5 months later, they're married, and they honeymoon in Tampa, Florida. And Tony goes to the big leagues in 1965. He even said at his statue, at his Cooperstown induction ceremony, I felt like my career began when I met Paterka. And it's true. It really did begin then.
Yeah. Well, on the other end, as important as Tony was for the Reds, they trade him. What did that do for him? And what do you think the implications were for the Reds?
Well, it's interesting because the Big Red Machine architect, Bob Housem, was a student of Branch Rickey. And the idea was you trade a player a year early, not a year late. And as early as 74, Housem was trying to trade Tony. He was trying to get Greg Nettles and ultimately did not get him, and he was glad the trade didn't go through. But was the comparison, which to me is the one we all need to make, is Housem thought he had the heir apparent to Tony and Danny Dreesen. The big difference was they were the same player in 77 when Tony was in Montreal, basically same numbers. But Tony just kept playing and playing and playing. One of the things I found out for the book was when Tony was 43, he had, along with Carlton Fisk, the 1-2 best seasons by a 43-year-old in baseball history. So whereas Danny Dreesen aged quickly, Tony basically didn't age at all. And that's the thing you can't project when you're saying trade a player a year early, because you just don't know how long is this guy going to last. Well, just like Joey Votto's having a great he's only 34, but I project him to have a very good late 30 career, as did Ted Williams. And obviously, Tony had that same career. Tony has a nice career in Montreal, nice career in Boston, and then Philly goes to the World Series in 83, comes back in 84. 85, he has a wonderful year. Yeah. 86 is his final year, and he retires. Takes him 9 years to make the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, 85 when he came back. I mean, he was basically platooning with Rose at first base.
And, you know, it was really, and people tend to forget this, we lament the fact that the Reds aren't that good in this last 3 or 4 year run, but the Reds were not very good for a while there in the early 80s.
Oh, yes.
And all of a sudden, here comes Housem, brings Dave Parker home, brings Pete Rose back, and of course, Tony was part of that deal. This became a very exciting baseball city in the mid 80s, and it's all because of Rose, Parker, and Perez. And of course, Concepcion was still here.
Yeah.
So what about Perez today? What did he do after baseball? What's he doing today?
Well, as we all know, he had that unfortunate 44-game opportunity as manager of the Reds, which I still consider my low point of 30 years covering the Reds. But I went on to manage the Marlins for a while, got a front office job with the Marlins, and just recently was let go unceremoniously along with Andre Dawson by Derek Jeter, which, by the way, that didn't get many points with me as a Hall of Fame voter. And our friend Derek Jeter may be hearing about that when he comes up. You just don't treat Hall of Famers like that. So I'll announce that right
now.
But Tony, his home in Cuba, where he grew up, got hit hard by the hurricane. His home in Puerto Rico basically got devastated, and the hurricane barely missed his home in Miami when it diverted its way west. So he had a tough off season this year. But when you're a Hall of Famer, not too much can faze you, and when you're Tony Perez, nothing fazes you.
So he's doing fine at this point.
Doing well.
So he has three different homes?
Yeah. Well, actually, his sister, Argelia, lives in the home in Central Violeta, Cuba. His home is in Puerto Rico. That got hit hard by the hurricane, and he has a in-season home in Miami where he's spending this offseason because the home in Puerto Rico is uninhabitable.
Yeah. So does he go back to Cuba?
He goes back occasionally. And he could not, in 72, when he went back because his father was ailing, he couldn't take Patuco or his sons. But he's been back several times. And what was interesting to me, Dan, was that except for his hometown of Central Violeta, nobody in Cuba knows who he is, which to me is incredible because he is the only Cuban major leaguer in our National Baseball Hall of Fame. I keep saying that because it's so rare. There's three other Cubans in there. But they didn't get to play Major League Baseball because they were at the time of the color line. So for Tony to be basically unknown for the most part, except among the real, as I call them, baseball cognoscenti in Cuba, is remarkable. And I knew that in 2010 when I talked to Rawlis Chapman when he was brought in for a press conference. And I said, you know who Tony Perez is? And he said, no. And I said to myself, bingo, there's got to be a story there because how can Rawlis, a great baseball player, not know who arguably their greatest star is, their only Hall of Famer, Tony Perez?
One of the problems with asking that question, as you found out, though, was the way we pronounce his name isn't the same as it's pronounced
exactly
in Cuba, right?
And I thought that would be the big solution when I was riding in the cab from Jose, I forget the name of the airport, Jose Marti Airport in Havana. I'm riding it to our apartment in Vidado for my 8-day stay, and it turns out when the cabbie didn't know who Tony Perez was, I said, oh, okay, I'll pronounce it like a good Spanish-speaking baseball fan, Tony Perez. He still didn't know who he was. And this guy was a great baseball fan. So that's when I knew I've got some work to do.
And that guy knew who Johnny Bench was,
and
Joe
Pete
Morgan,
Rose, and Joe Morgan.
And didn't know.
And that's because Fidel Castro caught off all the information about Cuban natives playing Major League Baseball. He did not want them to be idolized in any way back home.
And that's a real shame. I mean, that's
Tony, he's basically a man without a homeland, and that's a terrible thing.
Okay, I'd like to thank both my guests here for the second part of the show, John Arardi and Howard Wilkinson. And remind everybody that Tony Perez, From Cuba to Cooperstown, will be out next week be available in the bookstores. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, WVXU.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned on 91.7 for Here and Now, coming up next.